Classic song by the OJs, For the Love of Money, presented by the OJs, Kenneth Gamble, Leon Huff, and Anthony Jackson in 1973 as part of their album Ship Ahoy. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and that gave us a clue as to where we're headed today. We're talking big time money today. We are all about money, obsessed with money today. We're talking about two instances in which we see the love of money causing incredible destruction all over the world. And in those two instances, I refer to the Clinton Foundation, and I refer also to General Electric, and I also refer to one person who helped uncover the mountain of evils afflicting both these two entities. Well, our guest is not yet with us. Let me just see for a minute whether we have made contact. We've had a little trouble with our phones, but let me, you know, just put it on for a little, put the music on for a little bit longer, and let me have a chance to go check out, or let me see here if I can get another source, another way to reach him. And that's our guest, so Charles Ortel. Major developments, major developments. And we want to be able to talk about them because pretty soon they're headed for the end. And I say this not with a sense of joy, but it is a story, as you know, we have been covering here for a very long time. Let me see here. I'm just... Okay. All right, I'm trying something else to see if we can get him. And I think we will. So just put some music on in the background and we'll have him with us in no time. that. I want to have a few things that I want to say to you. We are bouncing back from a little snafu, a little hiccup we had yesterday with our phones. And today, I know you don't believe it, but actually they've been fixed. Things go wrong sometimes. There are glitches, and we usually have to be a little bit fluid. But we'll get through our program shortly enough. I just want to remind those of you who are interested in that health program that I've been talking about, and I want to remind you that there is space still available, but you have to move fast because the full complement is about to be achieved. People have been registering, but there's still space for those of you who have not yet registered and would want to do so. You call 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Okay. Signal from headquarters is that all is well. Charles, that should include you.
I'm on the line. I don't know if all is well, though.
It's all is well. All is well. So thank you for being with us. I was kind of mentioning to the audience that our topic today, we're talking about the Clinton Foundation, we're talking about General Electric, and this is just, it wasn't planned this way, but it worked out this way that you are central to both these subjects. You were the one who blew the whistle on General Electric, bringing to the public and warning the public all the way back in the 2008, that General Electric, 7-8, that General Electric was in fact engaging in fraud by overinflating its stock based on where it is today, and it is on very, very, very shaky ground. We'll talk about your feelings as this giant, this corporate giant, is about to go under from all predictions. But first, let's tackle the developments in the story we've been following for more than 2 years now. People might say, well, what do you guys have against the Clinton Foundation? As it turns out, there's a lot to have against the Clinton Foundation in the way it has operated, a reckless management style, but more importantly, the impact, a negative impact it has had in the black world. That is specifically my concern. Yours was looking at the books as a retired Wall Street banker who turned himself into a forensic investigator. That's where you go. That's how you understand things. You look at things from how the numbers tell the story. And for quite a while, you've assigned yourself the task of reading these books, insofar as they're made available, and you've been telling the story chapter and verse on what you have found. And lo and behold, we find that federal entities are finding the same thing. We find that foreign governments are undertaking their own investigations and coming to the same conclusion that this foundation was not in fact a foundation, not in the sense of the word, but it was a scam, a shield for doing business in a very different way to benefit the main people of this foundation, Bill Hill and Chelsea Clinton. So let's start off with there, and tell us, Charles, what is the latest swoop? Scoop.
Sure. And thanks, Yatrice, for having me back on. What I would say is that the Clinton Foundation, and it's really much more than one Simple Entity, the original one that was set up October 23rd, 1997 in Little Rock, is just one of many supposed charities operated around the Clinton family ever since October 1997. And the world, the not-for-profit world that you and I both and many listeners treasure, is something that really sets America apart. A lot of people, not necessarily the richest people, in fact, by number, it's the lower income people who give disproportionately to charities, if you count churches and other faiths, which are charities. These charities, if you were to add up all of their economic impact, and it's an estimate, obviously, it's not a precise figure, you're talking about maybe $1.7 to $1.9 of economic activity per year, which would make just the slice of our large economy, the largest in the world, that is engaged in not-for-profit activity, would make that, you know, among the top 10 countries in the world, just our not-for-profit sector. So many people, in fact, the overwhelming majority of people, take the strict laws very seriously when it comes to making sure that they, when they solicit money, in particular across state lines, using the mail, using the media, using the airwaves, that they only raise money for the authorized purposes of the charity. They take great care of these charities to have independent board members, people not enthralled to a certain political family, the Clintons, but instead people who understand that when there are conflicts of interest between the personal interests of a trustee or director and the stated purposes of a charity, well, the stated purposes of the charity control, and conflicted trustees or directors have to either stand down and have nothing to do with the decision, but more importantly, have to declare any of their potential conflicts. So when we speak of charity also in the United States, we're not talking about the Utrice Lead and Charles Martel Good Feeling Society, which, you know, doesn't exist on paper, is not really a legal entity, and therefore could not be a charity. No, to be a charity where you get tax exemption, tax for your annual results and tax deduction for your contributions, you have to be either a corporation, typically a non-profit corporation, an association, which is a legal structure, or a trust, which is a legal structure. You can't be a notional initiative. You can't be a loosey-goosey partnership. You can't be a project. You have to be an actual legal entity. And to be an actual legal entity, you have to pick a place in which you're going to domicile. And typically, that's a state, although some charities start in Washington, D.C. Keep it simple. You pick a state. They picked Arkansas. And you have to play by the rules of every state in which you operate. So in Arkansas, the rules are, as in most, I think all jurisdictions, in order to be a not-for-profit corporation, you have to have at least three, either you can call them directors or you can call them trustees. You have to have three of those people. If it's just two people, that's just like, it could be a partnership or just a proprietorship that's not as strict as having a minimum of three directors or trustees. Well, the Clinton Foundation, in its own tax forms filed in with the IRS in Ogden, Utah, for 1999 in 2000, and then also copied across state lines to many, many states, claims that it only has two. That's a bright line violation of the law, and you can't put that Humpty Dumpty back together again. You can't say, well, I operated for portions of 1999 with only two trustees. I'm still a charity. No, you're not. And, of course, nobody did anything about it in 99 and 2000 because Bill Clinton was president of the United States in his final period, having licked impeachment. So the trouble with this Clinton Foundation, my starting place with it is, it's, in my view, a gigantic slush fund. And it's a gigantic slush fund for people who were conscious that the Clinton family is in the political dynasty business. Bill was president. Everyone understood. I mean, it was not really a joke. I mean, it was almost an argument for the Clintons, to vote for the Clintons, that you were getting two for the price of one. And everybody following politics expected Hillary Clinton would eventually herself run for president, which she has so far done twice. So when you have a dynastic political family that's running around the world articulating the need for money for all these grandiose projects, but that doesn't go through the trouble of having independent directors, that doesn't form real legal companies, and operate them properly, that doesn't hire a serious accounting firm to check the books and be rigorous, you see this pattern and practice go on and on and on. And when you notice that the Clintons were technically bankrupt while president, their legal fees far exceeded their assets, as Bill left the White House with Hillary, Chelsea. And you then see them with Hillary at first a senator, then secretary of state, then a candidate. You see them go from technical bankruptcy to, by some estimates, being worth in the hundreds of millions of dollars. A normal person would say, wait a minute. You know, that sounds fun to me. I'll go around the world claiming I'm a philanthropist and become a multimillionaire in the process. I mean, something is badly wrong with that picture. And what animated me was not just to call out the fraud, but was when I noticed the disparate treatment that some people, for example, just today, we are often asked, you and I, to talk about the Trump Foundation. Well, today the Trump Foundation agreed to a stipulation, a voluntary stipulation, to liquidate the Trump Foundation following allegations by New York's then-acting Attorney General that the Trump Foundation and members of the Trump family had engaged in conduct which would appear to violate the law, that they may have used the Trump Foundation to advance political campaigns or a political campaign and for personal enrichment. The amount we're talking about in the Trump Foundation in this complaint is $2.8 million, which is a lot of money. But if one were to apply the same rules to the Clinton Foundation, you're talking, by my estimate, in a just using the declared revenues of the Clinton Foundation, you're talking about $3.2 billion. More than 1,000 times the size of these supposedly egregious offenses that have animated New York's Attorney General to go, you know, hell bent for leather against the Trump Foundation. So, what one of the things that made our country truly great, forget the political rhetoric, was confidence for a time that the laws of our nation would be applied equally against the rich and against the poor, and that you would get fair treatment before a blind lady of justice. Now, when that goes away, when the American public starts to believe, or the public in any nation starts to believe, that that's not how the system works, that maybe it's politically connected people who can get away with whatever they want to get away with, and people, the vast majority of Americans who care little about politics, you know, no, they're the sheep. You know, they have to play by the rules. And when some zealot in some attorney general's office somewhere in the state decides to go after you, you get treated unfairly. That then creates a market in political influence and creates a very, you know, it just turns this country into a disastrous place. And so I have to say that got me going. And then on the question of people like the Clintons wandering around the world at fancy parties and private planes and presidential suites at big banquets and resorts, claiming that what they were doing was helping disadvantaged people. I start with their economic position. Many of them, as you write, Patrice, happen to be people of color, Africans, people on the subcontinent in India and elsewhere, Papua New Guinea. But to me, the affront is that you would stand in front of these streams of money, billions of dollars of money that go regularly towards victims. And sadly, there are lots of victims, both of economic inequality, but worse, of natural disasters, the dread natural disasters in places like Haiti, that people who are supposedly well-educated, and in Hillary Clinton, supposedly one of the smartest lawyers on the planet, and Bill, you know, Rhodes Scholar, all these accolades, and the daughter, Chelsea, supposedly this well-educated PhD, the people like that, who should know better, would stand in front of these rivers of billions of dollars destined supposedly for Haiti, and then allow those monies not to be accounted for, and worse, possibly to be diverted into the hands of cronies and political associates, while these same victims in Haiti languish in poverty, in utter poverty, in rank conditions that, you know, no human being should have to suffer in this day and age, in 2018, with a planet that produces $80 trillion annually in economic output. Surely, our neighbor in Haiti, which is the poorest nation, I believe, in the hemisphere, should stand at the front of the line of any claim for help. Yet these Clintons, Bill Clinton to this day, still refuses to account in his role as co-chair of the interim Haiti Rescue Committee for many billions that in theory were sent under his care. Just outrageous.
Well, from the looks of things, they're not enjoying life at the moment. Although, of course, they attended a party in India this past week that reportedly cost $100 million. There is that kind of obscene wealth in the world. And all to have a good time and all to, outdo anybody else in the category of most money spent on a wedding. But they've been looking kind of dour. Their book tour has not, and their lecture circuit talks, which they were hoping would help them raise money to defray anticipated costs, that's not going well. In fact, the tickets started out at a very high price, and as last I looked, the tickets were being offered on as a group sale, at group sale prices. The halls that were rented were more than half empty, so it's not going well there, so they're not raising very much money in that department. And then we have the involvement of several foreign governments who have finally gotten a hint of how much money they were bilked of by the Clinton Foundation. France, Britain, Ireland, and many other countries have their own investigations going. But from the looks of things and from the demeanor of the Clintons lately, they're very... Although you got to give it to Hillary Clinton. She's acting like nothing has ever happened. Bill has been very taciturn in public. So I suspect that the hammer is about to fall, that we've been covering for this long time. I suspect that something is up. What do you suspect?
Yeah, I think you're right. Let's take the question of the tour and the book tickets and all that. One of the things I do on my podcast show on Wednesdays and Sundays is we're constantly zoning back in and looking at the reader reviews of the various books. And I'm not a huge fan of Amazon, but when you take a given book, one of the nice things that Amazon does tell you is how many copies of that book are for sale, at what prices. And you generally get a sense of how popular the book really is. Forget the reviews, because those can be spiked or stacked in favor of they can be rigged, let's just say. So what I noticed, and I am a book collector, principally first edition books, so, and I love books. So this comment will seem a bit irreverent, and I recoil in horror at the thought of ever burning a book. But that said, I do joke on the show. We try to do a calculation of how much a Duraflame log costs. Those things that you put in a fireplace, and those are like $5.99 or $6.99 per log. Well, it's now cheaper for you to go out and buy five or six copies of that ridiculous book, What Happened, that doesn't tell you anything at all about what truly did happen, for about $1 each. It's cheaper to buy five copies of that to start a fire than to buy a Duraflame log. So in terms of producing, I love books. I read voraciously, and I particularly enjoy books that will stand the test of time, that are not, just political commercials or other really meaningful exposés or great fiction or whatever. And, you can't say, you really cannot argue that anything I've seen or read of the Clintons comes close to being in that category. So if what they're going to produce in a written form, and obviously they would be helped by editors and ghostwriters and all that, if they can't produce a decent book, then I highly doubt I'm ever going to want to spend, anything more than, say, a Big Mac cheeseburger price to maybe sit through a session with the two of them where they're going to expound on the future. And so it's not surprising, and particularly given Bill's radioactive status in the midst of the valid concerns of the Me Too movement, it's not surprising that that speaking tour is going very poorly. Now, as to their status and whether they're, you know, their vulnerability to lawsuits, I believe it is massive. And you start with the issue that some of the top lawyers I'm dealing with, who, you know, have given me advice about the seriousness of this matter, they point out that the first major concern is the question of whether there is, in fact, an organization here. It's not whether it's a charity. Is the Clinton Foundation, whichever one you want to call, Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, is that actually an organization from a legal standpoint? If it is not actually a legal organization, then the Clintons and people around the Clintons are arguably vulnerable to massive personal IRS tax penalties. The IRS, if it wanted to be aggressive, could say, you know what, the scheme that you have been touting since October 23rd, 1997, was really nothing more than a way for you to get a whole bunch of what Hillary referred to in a State Department email as, quote, unencumbered dollars sent towards you that you wouldn't pay taxes on personally, and then worse, you would use to defray the purchase or the rental of private jets, it's expensive travel and high living and all that. And so here's the really bad news. All of the money that first came to you is taxable as personal income at federal, state, local rates because you didn't file a return claiming this. We're going to go back and assess penalties and interest. And by the way, your donors can't take a tax deduction for all the money that they sent towards the charity. And you end up, you know, the Clintons would then have to try to blame, say, the CFO, Andrew Kessel, or the accounting firm, or law firms, or other people. And that's not going to be an easy thing to win. So in a dire scenario where there is no Clinton magic wand of invincibility, where you're an ordinary human, a serious lawyer would be saying, listen, guys, you know, this is a longstanding pattern and practice of running a supposed charity, in fact, as a criminal enterprise, where you didn't pay your income taxes personally and where you used portions of this money to finance your very expensive re-election running campaign for senator the first time, re-election in 2006, primary the first time in 2007-2008, primaries the second time, 2015-16, and maybe you sprinkled some money around to your allies. So this, whatever the allegations are against the Trump Foundation, multiply them by more than 1,000. Again, it just, you know, at state level, in New York State, because the Clinton Foundation and the Trump Foundation both operate from New York State. And you've got now a spot on comparable in this Trump case. So if you're sitting there and as I say, you get the kind of lawyer that I always like to have, somebody who will sit you down and scare you and make sure you understand the true extent of your vulnerability, the potential penalties that could face this collection of charities is vastly exceeds the known net worth of the Clinton family. And you can be very sure if it goes down that direction that the various and sundry mega donors, the Gates, people like that, are not going to say, oh, yeah, we don't mind suffering a massive fine here. I mean, they're going to be very furious at the Clintons.
But the question is, having already uncovered massive irregularities in the way this foundation and its affiliates, its illegally constituted affiliates, have been operating, why do they still continue? Why are they still allowed to attract donors and bank money? We're talking, as you said earlier, billions with a B. Billions of dollars have just mysteriously disappeared. Why are they allowed to continue?
Well, so, you know, I actually recommended, at the very beginning of this, I recommended for the benefit, really, in part for the benefit of the Clintons, that they should immediately cease operations, because continuing to engage in this behavior is not helping their ultimate criminal culpability, in my view, as a non-lawyer. They have been, it's not like, you know, I'm not the only one out there making an issue of it. We had the two whistleblowers, Messrs. Moynihan and Doyle, who appeared last week for the Meadows Committee, subcommittee of oversight of the House, the representatives. Now, these are people who came to me several years ago, interested in my work, and have, you know, done far more work in a different way than I have, and they've reached their own independent conclusions, which they shared, and which I believe they will continue to share and are sharing with various government agencies. You know, it's not like there aren't a lot of people out there raising major league questions about this, and yet they continue. In fact, on my most recent podcast on Sunday, we were putting up pages from the Clinton Foundation, and lo and behold, a solicitation request popped up just in the middle of our own broadcast. So there, as we speak right now, their website is set up so that anyone who contacts it lands on the page that gets a solicitation. Each one of those requests, in my view, is a crime.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and start talking about the other big embarrassment, General Electric, right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.fm. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest is Charles Ortel, a very familiar voice on this program. He was the person who got this whole thing started about the Clinton Foundation and the myriad ways in which it was bucking the norm and billions of dollars unaccounted for. And he did this on his own as a retired Wall Street banker and declared very early on that something needed to be done there. But, of course, when you're taking aim at a former president and a former secretary of state and a former U.S. senator, it gets a little bit tangled up in bureaucracy. So that is happening, and we're reporting here today that things are not looking good on that front. Another place that things are not looking good is where Charles Ortel appeared in beginning in the 2008-2009 when, again, he independently began his investigation into General Electric and contended back then that General Electric was overinflating its stock and therefore robbing investors of their money. So it so happens, is this fate happening, where you happen to be in the middle of two extremely important cases involving lots of money, but more so involving governance. And the same way that the Clinton Foundation is an example of what happens or what could happen and what did happen when there is no governance in that sphere, the philanthropic world, here we see in the for-profit world a similar situation, General Electric running amok. Now it looks like it's about to fall, as you had predicted. And do you think that you were right on track to make that call?
Well, thanks for bringing this back up, Eutrice. Yeah, I mean, General Electric, again, and believe it or not, the Clinton Foundation as well, were cases that I stumbled upon by accident. I didn't intend to go after the Clinton Foundation. A friend of mine came to me, and after having watched me work on GE, which is much more complicated than the Clinton Foundation, he came to me and said, listen, can you take a look at this Clinton Foundation? I can't figure out what the hell's going on with it. And I guess I'm one of these independent people who doesn't really like to pursue other people's ideas. I prefer to come up with them on my own. So, you know, we've talked about the Clinton Foundation. The rest of that is history. In the case of GE, in 2006, late in six, I had spent about 4 years in the wilderness, literally, in a very nice town in upstate New York, two different places, with my kids who then were, just going through school. And I had gained residential custody of these two wonderful people, and I really needed to focus on them. So I didn't do much other than focus on them until mid, late 2006, when they kind of noticed that it's tough to live when you don't work. And so it encouraged me to think about going back to work, and I spent a little time saying, all right, let's reacquaint myself with where the markets were. What were the markets telling me, as somebody who understands how to look at financial statements? What were they telling me about whether companies were over or undervalued? And so I selected 25 large companies that have public financial statements, and I began a rigorous analysis of each of them. And one of them that had always been sold to me, and I'd had business dealings with General Electric, with the top GE people I was dealing with, would always lecture me about what an idiot I was in comparison to how carefully they did all their finances, and they had 700 accountants, and, I was just a tiny little person. I couldn't have any prayer of keeping up with them. Anyway, I fully expected the parent company, the consolidated financial statements of a company as big and as well-funded as General Electric, so much in the public eye, to have pristine financials. And I literally could not believe, I thought I was going crazy. Or I had gone crazy when I looked at the financial statements in depth, starting early in '07, I went, and by April of '07, I went to a close friend and I said, "Listen, you've known me for 20 plus years. We've done a lot of things together, a lot of complex deals. I explained that I'd been really not doing much except being with my kids, and then I started on this project." And I said, the guy's name, I just said, "Listen, you're probably going to think I'm crazy, because what I want to do is go back into the city and tell my friends in the city and around the world that I think GE is a complete disaster and could go bankrupt." And he looked at me and he listened to the analysis and he said, "Charles, everybody knows you're crazy, but on this one, you're right." And so, we spent a fair amount of time stress testing it. But the basic argument against GE then, and the argument against it now, is that in the first instance, in the modern world, you don't really need a management team to put together a conglomerate for you. If you want to have investments in, say, 8 or 9 or 10 different types of businesses, you can just go out and buy common stock through any brokerage account, and you don't have to overpay. You don't have to pay to gain control, what's called an acquisition premium, to put together this gigantic mess. The second issue with GE that I saw in the beginning is where the research community was covering it as if it were an industrial concern, with its vaunted businesses and power and all sorts of different well-known brand names. In actual fact, I viewed it then, and I still, to the extent, view it now, as a bad bank. As a bank that's much smaller than the Husky competitors. And banking is a very tough business around the world. There's always some idiot in some country who's prepared to take a risk that he or she should not take in order to gain market share. So you can very, it's an ups and downs kind of business. Perceived, moated front runners can quickly get in trouble. For example, right now, Goldman Sachs, which is a very able collection of highly skilled and highly paid people, the top people at Goldman Sachs are under scrutiny for their involvement in a Malaysian scandal that has already taken a substantial toll on the market value of that gigantic enterprise, which I think is in the Dow at this point. It's a very big company. So the banking business is a tough business. The top professionals in the banking business walk out the front door every day, and they can be recruited to another firm very easily. So in addition, you now have to contend with regulations that are far more complicated and intrusive than they used to be. And so when you look at banks, what you see actually, it's going to sound and that made it sound very difficult to understand them, but there's one ratio that is very useful in figuring out whether a bank is fairly priced or not, and that's to take what's called its tangible value. That means it's the value of its common shares in its books, not affected by market values, and you subtract out of that any intangible value, like goodwill, patents, things like that. You subtract that, and you come up with what's called the tangible book value, divide that by the number of common shares, and then you compare that result to the market price. And in challenging moments as now, where there's a lot of market volatility, you should see ratios much above 2, 1.5, 2 for a large bank, you know, multi-billion-dollar bank. What I did back in 2007 was to assign a fair value to what I thought the finance business was, subtract that value from the total value, and then look at some other ratios to see just how overvalued the residual, the supposed industrial businesses were, and I came up with massive overvaluation. And I then went around, I talked to a lot of the very shrewd debt investors. Actually, people talk about equity investors. Those are the names you know. The people who are shrewdest, and I found in this business, are the debt investors. The debt markets are vast, and to be a shrewd debt investor, you've got to be very good at reading legal agreements, not just financial statements. And so the debt markets were saying back in 2007, 8, and 9, that GE should not have been assigned a AAA rating, and therefore was, and in fact, it was the debt markets were screaming caution. So I pushed really hard on it. When I started on it, GE stock price was about $40 per share, and at the low point, it reached $6.66 in March of 2009. Of course, that's when Barack Obama was just starting out in his first full year as president, and the governments of the world, our own included, and the central banks of the world, so we cannot let financial Armageddon sink these big multinationals, so we're going to bend all the rules. General Motors was restructured in a way that I don't agree with, that broke, I think, several law, important laws and precedents. Central banks pushed interest rates onto the floor, pushing up asset values into bubble territory, and governments like our own began to run massive annual operating deficits, piling on debt. So there are all kinds of external measures taken to lend an appearance of progress, starting from really 2008 to the present. And I said along the way that these measures were just like cotton candy. They're not nourishing. You know, they may be fun to eat if you like sweet things, but it's not going to actually address the underlying structural problems, which include that we have too much productive capacity in nations like ours, mismatched to where people want to live. We have enormous pressures on private sector wages from technology, from robots, from countries that have talented people who are happy to work for a lot less than Americans are prepared to work for. And just pushing interest rates down and piling on government debt wasn't going to solve any of those problems. And then when it comes to GE, one of the things that's really interesting to look at in GE, back in 2008, oil prices were, I think on one category, were approaching $120 a barrel. Today, West Texas Intermediate oil is trading at $47, $48 a barrel, which is way down from 2008, 10 years ago. That's not good. And it's really not good for a GE because of all the different things, correlations that I've noticed, the strongest one for GE is that when energy prices are trending upwards and are high, then a lot of GE's infrastructure projects make sense, where governments around the world decide, you know, they're rich, the oil kingdoms and other places that sell energy, they look at these things and they say, wow, this is a great time to put up new power plants or new large infrastructure projects. And airlines look at this and say, wow, with high oil prices, energy prices, that means we need better fuel-efficient machines, and GE used to sell locomotives. I'm not sure they do that anymore. So in high energy price, trending higher environment, GE's backlog balloons, its prospects look good. But the converse is also true. With falling oil prices, at low oil energy prices, GE's core businesses don't tend to have a bright outlook. And then on top of that, ever since I began this process in 7, 8, 9, people around the world have been looking at buying pieces of GE that they thought might ultimately be sold. GE has sold off a tremendous number of businesses. And today, much of what they own is shop-worn. So you're left with businesses that, you know, have lost their luster. You've got to demoralize. Now, this is the third CEO. So Immelt came in September 7th, 2001, and then he was replaced by Flannery, who was just replaced by a man named Culp. And I have to believe there was a long article in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. I think it ran to 30 pages that talked about the state of GE, and it certainly described to me a demoralized internal team that can't seem to shoot straight, on top of which there are all these liabilities. GE was built with a AAA balance sheet, a strong balance sheet, and a lot of the legal contracts that were written never really contemplated that GE would be in the place where they are today. So as their credit quality erodes, their liabilities, their potential liabilities, get bigger. And they still haven't topped up their pension plan, which I think is reprehensible that they have not put money aside for their retirees and workers. I think if you enter into a contract with your retirees and workers, you need to honor that contract, and you shouldn't be paying large bonuses to senior management, as was the case, for shoddy performance, and not have taken care of your retirees in the pension plan, and not have put money aside for pollution remediation, and there's large liabilities for that, particularly in the Northeast. So you look at this and you ask yourself, you know, of all the complex things you might want to invest in, is this the smartest place to consider even spending time thinking about investing in GE, let alone parting with cash? And then you start thinking, as I had, you know, long ago experienced buying companies and trying to fix them up and sell them, that were operating in multiple countries. So GE operates in, I think, more than 100 countries. The financial statements that most mortals look at in the public domain do not even come close to being what the real financial statements are going to look like country by country. Because in each country where GE operates, its mix of businesses is slightly different, its assets and liabilities are slightly different, the rules are different for operating, the currencies can be different, the laws are different, and it's just very, very complex to figure out what is the true credit capacity of something like this spread all over the world, what guarantees has it made, what obligations might it have, what losses could it face. And you get to a place, now 10 years into this, where you may look at this and say, you know what, I'm not gonna have an easy time restructuring this out of bankruptcy. Maybe the right approach here is to just suck it in and try to restructure this via bankruptcy.
At what point, Charles, does all of this cross the line between, well, bad business decisions, people are making very poor decisions, to criminal activity?
Great question. So when I got out of business school, I was studying from 78, that is to say 1978, not 1878, to 1980. And, you know, back then, GE also was in trouble. There was a stagflation period and high interest rates and all that. But GE subsequently, from 81 to about 2001, was thought of as, you know, the miracle company. Flirted with trouble in 79, 80, 81. Welch comes in. It's does phenomenally well. Multiple success stories are touted in cases, and Welch gets lionized in books about him, books he writes, articles about him. He was voted, I think, the business executive of the century on his way out when he retired September 7th, 2001. And so, lo, how the mighty have fallen. And there are, I actually was just out of it was a simple thing here in New York where I got a chance to spend time with the dean of Harvard Business School alone and then a top professor. And I said, you know, warn him. I said, gentlemen, both of my projects I'm working on now, Clinton Foundation and GE, seem to be coming together at the same time. And, you know, you guys like to write cases and have your students study. I think that And I know from my own experience long ago that we weren't really taught the warning signs for fraud. People don't like to even discuss fraud. But sadly, fraud is a fact of life. And I think there should be more said encouragement to get people to put their professional skepticism hat on. And when you see a mess like this, where a lot of people have made a lot of money, but where you're left with a disaster, and you see it in both a not-for-profit and now in a for-profit setting, we have to learn from this. And I hope the full extent of the problems will be shared and taught, and that there will be scalps here. And people who have cooked the books at GE, if that happened, they need to go to prison. Executives who've maybe taken too much money by way of bonuses and compensation for illusory success, they need to go to prison. They need to pay that money back into a fund. When you leave behind a company, a husk that could have the responsibilities that society at large will have to deal with, and pensions, the environmental, you can't let people walk away with hundreds of millions of dollars or more as executives and leave behind a mess for the taxpayers to deal with. That's just that's a misalignment of incentives. And it really should be another area where people on the right and the left agree. We ought to have one set of rules for foundations, one set of rules for for-profit entities. You got to play by the rules. If you account by the rules and you account properly and you do great work in the for-profit world, the trustees will decide and the shareholders will decide, directors will decide how much money you should make. But you can't set up a system that's just, you know, an exercise for connected executives and you know, part-time, not really focused directors to reward and encourage this type of moral hazard behavior. It's just simply not right. And so these are two test cases. A lot of eyes need not to focus on the test cases. And we need to learn as a nation and as a planet. We need to learn from this experience so that it doesn't, neither case happens as frequently again.
Well, we have to leave it there for today because we're running out of time. And we have a very vicious timekeeper who tells me by just starting the music, you're out of time. So we don't want that to happen. But quickly, could you, Charles, let people know how they can continue to keep a track of some of the issues that you're discussing on, I know, Sunday with Charles. What is the other program that you have?
It's called Closing In, and if you just punch in Sunday with Charles or Closing In with my name, Charles Wortel, you'll get to a playlist. I'm doing my 128th show tomorrow at 5 p.m. Since last August. And also I'm on Twitter at Charles Wortel, O-R-T-E-L-1-L. Those are the two best places to follow me.
Well, I've been promising to have just a Q&A session with you. So let's arrange that and see, you know, have you available to answer people's questions. I can't anticipate them, and it's best if they ask them themselves. And I'm so happy that you have agreed to be available. We'll just have to plan it. And let's do that soon.
I really enjoy the questions. The tougher, the better.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And that brings us to the end of our program today. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. One thing I want to stress is that the work that we've been doing here on PRN is second to none. I'm very proud of that. And this is why it is important that you support the station to keep us going. Nobody else has this kind of information, I guarantee. Because many people have been following us. We know that. They're listening in. They're taking notes. And they are contacting Charles for what he knows. And other people are beginning to network with each other to bring these matters to resolution. So it all starts with good, solid work. It's not sexy. I'm not doing this for some kind of prize. It is what I consider good journalism, to stay the course with the subject and to make space available for people who know what they're talking about. That does not happen with the general media. So thank you for supporting PRN, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye. Thank you.